Welcome to the Incidental Economist Podcast. Today's date is August 18th, 2011. You're joining me, Aaron Carroll, and Austin Fracht.
Yeah, so this is our third podcast, and I want to tell everyone I'm really appreciative of the feedback we've been getting. It's been positive, and people seem to like the podcast. We've had hundreds of downloads of our podcast so far. You know, it'd be great if it was thousands, but we'll take hundreds. Hundreds is good. And
it's a start.
Yeah, it's a start. And but more importantly, it's the quality of the listeners that we appreciate, not just the quantity. And you know, the number one,
which we can tell from the downloading.
Yeah, the number one highest quality listener is my mom. She's heard every podcast so far. She's probably listening now, I hope. So hi, Mom, and thanks for listening. And we welcome your feedback, everyone. So today we're going to talk about Paul Meyer, who passed away earlier this week. I think it was last Sunday. And Aaron, you wrote a post about him, and why don't you maybe tell us who he is and what he did?
Yeah, so Paul Meyer is a biostatistician who came to prominence, I think, mostly in the 50s and later, but he's mostly well known for being one of the most vocal and one of the earliest proponents of randomization. You know, today we take for granted the randomized controlled trial, the idea that we will, by chance, assign people to get one therapy or another, or to be assigned to one intervention or another in order to see what the results are. Before this and throughout his career, he was confronted with the idea that doctors could just tell whether patients would, whether therapies would work or not, and where their patients should be assigned. They could just tell what was the right thing to do, and that the idea that randomizing people one with the other somehow ignored this brilliance that physicians or other scientists might have. And he met quite a fair amount of opposition of people who wanted to avoid the use of randomized controlled trials, but through his work and through his dogged persistence, he convinced people that this is the way to go.
Today, of course, I have to be honest. I thought. I remember having this realization a few years ago. I thought that everything in medicine had been nailed down by a randomized clinical trial, and physicians are practicing things that we know work. You hear about medical science. You know, it's a science, right? I thought. And it turns out that's not true. And moreover, Paul Meyer had to fight to even get the idea across that it was important.
Yeah, I tell people all the time, you'd be shocked at how little of what we do in medicine has actually been confirmed through a randomized controlled trial. And some things, of course, can't be, and we can get into a little bit of that. But there's so many things that can and just aren't. And I still run into physicians every day who say they don't care about the randomized controlled trial. And if I say, well, look, we did a study and we randomized people and this arm found this and that arm found that, they'll say, oh, but my patient is different. Or I can tell that my patient wouldn't be the same, or that I would get a result that you would not see, and that they just ignore it. The randomized controlled trial is still really not as widely accepted as it should be. It's sort of shocking, but it certainly is with respect to sort of drug approval and some of the bigger things that we do. And the fact that it's gotten as far as it has is really, it's due to Paul Meyer.
I think probably most people, when they think of randomized controlled trials, unless they're involved in health services research, they probably think of drug clinical trials. And we should probably take a minute to make sure everybody knows exactly what we mean by an RCT, a randomized controlled trial. And what we mean literally is you've got a group of people and you flip a coin for each person. You say, heads, you're going to get this treatment. You're going to get this drug. You're going to have whatever intervention it is. And by the way, it doesn't have to be in medicine. There's randomized controlled trials and other areas of investigation. But you flip a coin, heads, you get it. Tails, you don't get it. And then off we go, and ideally it's blind, so that people actually don't know whether they get the intervention or not. So there's there's no placebo effect, no difference in placebo effect. Ideally, even the investigator doesn't know. So a double blind randomized control trial, nobody knows what's going on, but somehow it's rigged so that half the or some random proportion of the population is getting an intervention and the other isn't. And then later you get the data, you reveal who got what, you do your analysis, and you can just compare what happened.
This is the only way really to fully remove bias. A very well done randomized controlled trial is really the only way to completely try to get rid of that. Because of course, if you don't do a controlled trial and you just test if something works, you're going to get placebo effect or people knowing that it works just because they believe it to be so. And that's been shown in trial after trial. If you do a controlled trial but you don't randomize it, then there are lots of ways in which you can subconsciously or even consciously assign people in different ways that will bias you. For instance, if we don't randomize and I wind up giving all the people who show up early in the morning a certain therapy and perhaps all the people who show up in the afternoon a different therapy, maybe the people in the morning are all unemployed and poor and out of work, and the people in the afternoon are all well-educated, much healthier people who have jobs, and I've just biased my trial. And there are often ways we can't even imagine bias.
Sure.
And only by randomizing can you fully and absolutely get rid of that. And it's important. It's essential to the sort of the best kind of outcomes and proven causality. And that's why we have to do them.
So I think the question that probably occurs to many people, certainly did to me, is why aren't we doing this all the time with everything? You know, what we should be doing massive numbers of randomized controlled trials. It's just a no-brainer. There are actually reasons why we aren't and why we can't. No doubt we could and probably should do more, but it's important to point out, if it's not obvious, that these kinds of studies take money. They often take a lot of money.
Yeah, they're very expensive.
Yeah, they can be very expensive because you have to do primary data collection. You know, you have to actually get people to consent to do the study. You have to find the subjects. You have to, you know, actually implement the intervention. You have to do it carefully and in a controlled way, obviously. Sometimes it's a long period of time over which you want to do it. You have to collect the data, clean the data, analyze the data, so on and so forth. These things can cost multi-hundreds of thousands of dollars, or if they're really complicated, even millions of dollars to do and span over many years in some cases.
I mean, I can tell you just from personal experience, we have a number of trials going that are randomized controlled trials of sort of interventions and clinical decision support. They're $1 to $2 to $3 million
sure.
each. They cost a lot of money. They take years. And these are not, you know, going to change the world or set the world on fire. These are very expensive and time intensive, and it's hard to do them.
I remember when I had my first job out of grad school and I was just writing proposals and doing the budgets for them. And, you know, we weren't doing RCTs, just you know, pretty simple studies. And they cost several hundred thousand dollars to do just because of the investigator's time. I mean, you're talking about people
right.
with advanced degrees. You know, when you just add it up, you know, get a couple of FTEs of someone with an advanced degree, you're out a few hundred thousand dollars with fringe and overhead and so forth. So, you know, a randomized controlled trial can easily cost millions.
Yeah. And you know what? I'm putting a mental note here is that, you know, discussing why research in general is so expensive would make a great future podcast.
Oh, it shocked me when I saw the first budget. I looked at it and said,
yeah.
Wow, that's more than my house. And
yeah,
we're just talking
crazy.
a couple of years. I couldn't believe it. You know, I was coming from grad school where I was used to working for a beer, you know. Anyway, so these things
but,
are...
Okay, so let's get back to randomized controlled trials. I think we should point out another reason that they don't happen all the time is that there are topics you can't do them in.
That's right.
For instance, breastfeeding in the world of pediatrics is one we have all the time where, you know, we would love to do a randomized controlled trial to prove that breastfeeding causes better health and follow people out for years. But I can't ethically randomly assign people, you're going to breastfeed, you can't.
Right.
You can't do that. It's not okay. And nobody's going to accept it, and we wouldn't even propose it.
And you say it's not okay because we already have enough evidence about the benefits of breastfeeding that you cannot, it would be unethical to just...
Well,
is that
I was going to bring up that with smoking, with breastfeeding. It's more that's an obvious parent choice. Like, I can't tell someone you can't breastfeed.
Not even with consent?
I also can't make someone breastfeed if I want them to.
Well, what about with consent? If someone consents to be in the trial and they know,
Then it's like the consent to say that you would agree to be randomly assigned to breastfeed. Now, that would take such a skewed population of people that would be ungeneralizable.
Right, that's right.
That we wouldn't do it. My other favorite example is, you know, you'll often hear people that, you know, say that they've never proven that smoking causes cancer. Well, yeah, because, again, I can't do a randomized controlled trial and get these 1,000 people to smoke and prevent these 1,000 people from smoking and then see if they get cancer years later. That's one where we have so much overwhelming associated evidence and such a bad outcome, it'd just be unethical. You could never do it.
Right. And the other thing to point out about trials like this, in fact, I think all research, and certainly all research that's federally funded or at any institution that has receives federal funds, has to go through an institutional review board that checks that you're not doing anything unethical. So even if you were an unethical person and you wanted to do one of these, you couldn't get any funding for it. Just couldn't be done.
Yeah. There are times also when randomized controlled trials aren't perfect. And we should also make clear that like all research is imperfect, and even randomized controlled trials can be bad. Just because they're randomized and controlled doesn't mean they're phenomenal. If you're looking at a very skewed population that's not generalizable, if I do a randomized controlled trial only of, incredibly healthy mostly healthy 35-year-olds who are working, I can't then extrapolate it to, what's going to happen to 80-year-olds who are sick. This is one of the problems that people sometimes have, for instance, with the RAND health insurance experiment, is that it was looking mostly at a pretty healthy group of people who were working or of working age in one small sort of place in the country. It's hard to then extrapolate to that that's going to function exactly the same way if we've been looking at 80-year-olds.
So this gets to
chronically ill people.
This gets to internal validity versus external validity. Internal validity is where the trial's well run and you get legitimate results that apply to the actual population you studied, that was involved in the trial. That would be an internally valid trial. But if that population is not representative of a broader population that's of interest to you, then it's not. It lacks external validity or generalizability.
Yeah, and so even then, it's randomized controlled trials is really important to do them, and they have real power. But even then, they can be flawed. So it's still important to make sure you're doing it and to not generalize or take too much of them, too much from them than you should.
So I want to point to
that goes for all research.
I want to point to a few alternatives when you can't do a randomized controlled trial, or there's insufficient funding for it, or it's unethical, or to address in part this generalizability issue. And so there's other kinds of studies called observational studies that take data as it already exists. It's not original, not primary data collection. There's no randomization, no purposeful randomization, and tries to deduce something about the world, and preferably or oftentimes with the aim of trying to deduce a causal relationship. And so if you want to deduce a causal relationship, you do need some element of randomness, because otherwise you get spurious findings that where you have one thing, A causes B, but B can also cause A, and to tease that all apart, you need something random, something that drives A in a random way, and then you see what happens to B. So sometimes you can exploit natural experiments, and this is where there's some randomization in the world that the researcher didn't insert, but just found, not necessarily by, quote, nature, but just by the nature of institutions and policy. So this happened in Oregon recently, and we wrote about it on the blog about the Oregon health insurance experiment, where Oregon randomized people or had a lottery that people enrolled in to see whether they could be let into their Medicaid program or not. So they selected at random a subset of the people who had gone on this list. They had this lottery, and some people got into Medicaid and some people didn't. So that's randomization that the researcher didn't do, but the state of Oregon did, and then researchers went and analyzed the consequences of it. And it's one of the only randomized studies, really, of health insurance and of Medicaid enrollment. I'm not going to go into the findings of that, because we've done it on the blog, and that's not, this is not a podcast about that, although we could do one on that. And finally,
yeah, absolutely.
Another way to tease out causality is to use instrumental variables approaches, which, again, it's basically on the continuum. It does exploit some randomness that's in the world, but it does so with some pretty sophisticated econometric techniques that I certainly can't talk about on the podcast, but have on the blog a lot. But I just raise all these to say that there's other approaches even to get at causality, but they're you have to get lucky. You know, there has to be a natural experiment that exists, or some phenomenon that you can argue is random. You know, you have to sometimes do some fancy statistical work. But still, these are very valuable because you can't do an RCT all the time. Some of these observational techniques will be have broader generality, they're vastly cheaper. So you can do, you know, maybe 10 observational studies for every randomized controlled trial. So, you know, it's the kind of thing where if you're looking to sort of figure out where to do the next RCT, it might make sense to do a lot of observational studies first to just to get a general sense of, you know, is this area likely to be fruitful?
Yep.
Anyway, Paul Mayer is known for another thing, the Kaplan-Meier survival analysis.
Yep.
Which I've never used myself, actually. I've just heard about.
I actually have, I think, used it once, and I'll talk about that briefly towards the end. But anyone who's ever heard of a, you know, what's the 5-year survival rate or what's the 10-year survival rate? We often talk about this with respect to cancer or other sort of things that might kill you. Again, you got to thank Paul Mayer. He and obviously Kaplan, his colleague at the time, developed the technique by which we can, you know, measure for a certain amount of time and figure out the statistical test needed to do to figure out the proportion of people who meet certain outcomes at certain periods of time. You can't, you know, talk about most serious illnesses and treatment, and certainly in the doctor's room, you know, when you're talking to your doctor and you're told that you're ill, the first and almost most important thing you care about is, you know, what's the 5-year survival? What's the 10-year survival? You know, what's going to happen to me? And that technique and the fact that we talk about survival rates these days, again, is thanks to Paul Mayer. He was, you know, part of the statistical team that figured out how to do that. I used it actually in a much less consequential study that we performed once. I was interested in seeing how good a pediatric research meeting was, and so we took all the abstracts that were submitted, and then we wanted to see how many of them were published by 4 or 5 years, and so we basically said that the outcome we're looking for is publication. We set the time frame, and we, you know, collected all the data, and again, the statistical test we used was Kaplan-Meier survival. So we wanted to look at, you know, what's the survival for how long it takes these things to get published. These kind of statistical tests have multiple uses, from, you know, things we judge to be, you know, less serious, but most importantly, all the way out to death and what's going to happen to my loved ones. And that's, again, Kaplan-Meier statistics.
Yeah, as best I understand it, you can use this approach for anything that is binary and happens once. So like time to failure of some component in some mechanical system. So it's used in engineering to say, you know, what's the probability that this device is going to fail, you know, in 2 years, 3 years, and so forth. You know, that's a binary thing. It either fails or it doesn't, and it only fails once. You know, length, I've heard that it's used in to study the length of unemployment. Yeah, you can be unemployed and reemployed multiple times. So that doesn't only happen once, but you can only be reemployed once after unemployment. So what's the sort of, quote, survival time? It's not survival, but length to your next job. So how long are people likely to be unemployed? I'm sure that type of analysis is being done with Kaplan-Meier approaches all the time right now, since unemployment is such a big issue. So it has broad applicability, and we owe it to Paul Mayer and Kaplan. You know, in reading his obituary, I read several, actually. Some people said, you know, he wasn't well known enough during his life. You know, he's just well known in small circles, and we owe so much to him. You know, how much of medical science and what we know is due to his championing of that approach. You know, randomized controlled trials. I don't know if anybody's quantified it, but it's probably an awful lot.
I would imagine that, you know, he's one of those sort of unsung heroes, because you know, everybody will remember the drugs and everything else, then the therapies and the procedures that saved their lives. But the sort of, again, the statistical tests and the study designs that allowed us to figure all of that out are due in no small part to Paul Mayer, and he deserves the credit.
Yep. So I wish we had delivered that credit during his life, but we're doing the best we can, and here it is, after the fact, on a podcast.
And that seems like a good place to wrap things up for this week. We hope you've enjoyed listening to the podcast. We're still, of course, and forever welcoming feedback and thoughts. We will continue to try to improve things both on our end and on a technical end. And we look forward to seeing you next week. Thanks a lot.